Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's Saturday, the 16th of July, 2016. Actually, nothing is a good topic, nothing itself. Nothing. Nature abhors a vacuum. And we know that a vacuum is a quantum vacuum, pure vacuum is a quantum vacuum. And it's full of virtual particles. So even nothingness is pregnant. And particles emerge and disappear in a quantum vacuum. There's a dance of nothingness. Nothingness always teeters on the edge of somethingness. And this is kind of true of the emptiness of meditation, the silence of samadhi.
Hello.
I do. And that silence is extremely pregnant, just as a quantum vacuum is extremely pregnant. It wants to create. It has this kind of pressure intrinsic to it. Of course, it's the silence of a human being at the end of the day. And human beings do stuff, regardless. It's almost like the most lazy and inert person, unless they're actually kind of in some kind of a coma, will do something, will act. And even the most reclusive yogi who is committed for some reason to an utter passivity, mental, physical, emotional, etc., will also still do something. Might even only just be eat a bowl of rice, but there is doing. And for those of us who think that spiritual practice, so-called, needs to happen in the world, it needs to be embedded in the world. And there is nothing wrong with the active householder, chancer, rascal, scoundrel life in the world, and it's perfectly compatible with a dedication to meditation and self-inquiry. Ultimately, there's no difference, you know, between the void and its products, you know, between the fullness and the emptiness. Again, we have some dichotomies that we need to de-absolutize before it leads us astray, and we need to realize that this is a binary again, which also fuses into one at some point. So. Nothing is something, and something is nothing. The way of expressing this is really just to speak about boundaries, and to realise that boundaries are not fixed. They don't have any kind of absoluteness about them. They don't have any ultimate rigidity about them. Everything passes. Nothing is permanent. Even the great Himalayan mountains are not permanent. Actually, if you go to the Himalayas and get off up there into the high mountains, you notice that it's flowing before your eyes. Whenever the Indian government manages to scrape a road with a bulldozer, a good rainstorm and it's gone, it's swept down into the valley. And certainly every winter destroys the roads and have to be recreated. So you'd think something like a mountain has this great solidity. Or something like a planet, you know. You stare off into outer space and stars explode with extraordinary violence, you know. So even though some boundaries might endure for a very long time, especially by the human scale of time, where we measure things by our 70 life expectancy. Nevertheless, everything is changing, and that means basically that the boundaries which enclose what we take to be things or entities of some sort, and actually shifting, sometimes quickly by the human scale, sometimes slowly, but nevertheless shifting. Nothing is permanent. And that's the reason we both allow boundaries and take cognizance of them, but at the same time we don't endow them with a huge significance. So we're not going for the kind of nihilism of everything is just really like grey goo, and everything that you see, which of course is an enormous pattern of lines and shapes, ultimately lines, you know, ultimately boundaries enclosing a leaf, a canal full of water, a path, a cloud, a bridge, a boat, a person, another person. Instead of denying what you see and castigating it as being like some kind of illusion that you're in a dream, you don't do that. It's really silly and life-negating. At the same time, it's always in your consciousness that these boundaries, these lines are dancing in a swirling pattern, and there will be no more at some point. What we're observing actually is turbulence. It's turbulence. Turbulence is the nature of existence. So there is existence. The lines that you see are real, but their significance is overestimated by a language and the conceptual apparatus, the basic unit of which is the thing, you know, and the thing is the steady boundary. And that's what kind of leads us away from a world picture of flow and turbulence and impermanence and lines, sure enough, but shifting lines, moving lines, lines which appear, dance, disappear, reappear, dance, disappear. So in that way, nothing is something, something is nothing. Yeah. And it's out of nothing that things emerge, and back into nothing that they re-merge. Of course, turbulence varies. Now this canal surface is relatively still. It's not like a river, it's not, it's certainly not fast flowing. Having said that, you can probably hear water flowing there, and that's the overflow, and the canal gets too full, water flows out. When it needs filling up, water flows in. And the kind of turbulence, the flow of human life and the flow of world history is like that. It has periods when it's extremely turbulent, and periods when it's less so. And it does seem to be pretty turbulent at the moment. It was last night or yesterday afternoon, I think there was a military coup in Turkey, or an attempt at a military coup, which, if the various sources are to be believed, has probably been crushed now by the president. Interesting, you know. I've been in talking about Brexit, I've been kind of making a claim that there's a tendency to fragmentation all over the place. Now that probably sounds like I'm talking like an astrologer, you know, there's a certain planetary configuration that's causing or is synchronous with political and social turbulence on Earth. You know, it does sound like a magical explanation. There is this tendency, is just arising from somewhere out of the collective unconscious or whatever, towards fragmentation. I actually think we could probably trace that tendency back to various recognisable, empirically observable and nameable forces. Even though I think you're going to come up with something pretty complex. In the case of Turkey, which is interesting, The leaders of the coup seem to be like colonel level army officers. Makes one think of the Greek colonels. Yeah? Whatever's going on in Turkey seems to come from that similar strata of the army. Turkey is no stranger to coups. I think there hasn't been one in the 21st century. I don't know when the last one was, in the 1980s. And it's usually that the military attempts to re-establish some kind of democracy when it's been perceived that there was some kind of dictatorial authoritarian tendency it was taking over and attenuating the fragile democracy. And similarly, Russian art was given this time. The army wallahs in the coup announced in fact that they'd won rather prematurely, and saying that Erdogan, the president of Turkey, was dismantling the democracy. And he certainly, from what make out, an authoritarian character. I mean, he was the prime minister for 11 years before he got himself elected president, which in the constitution is largely a ceremonial office, but which he's tried to turn into an executive president, rather like the American presidency, which has got executive power rather than just a purely ceremonial function. So he's been prosecuting that agenda, and he's an Islamist, and he's right wing. And of course, Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, who himself was a military man and a military hero, possibly, depending how you want to read it, but seems to have been a pretty dynamic character. He reformed Turkey, and it's basically on the back of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and all of that stuff. And as a modern, secular, democratic state, and he actually kind of outlawed political Islam, which entailed closing all the dervish lodges and so forth like that, which wanted to go for a secular state, modernising. And Erdogan represents a backlash against that, you know, some many decades later. And it seems to have boiled down to that you kind of got industrialisation, commerce, and all the trappings of Western modernity in the big cities, and a whole host of younger people getting educated and becoming champions of modernity, so-called, as a result of that. Whereas in the vast hinterland, people remained Islamic. So there's this, like, the schism in the society, a massive split in Turkish society. And it's very, you know, there is enormous tension in the country. And especially with Erdogan's authoritarian tendencies. And he's kind of backward looking politics. That's just going to rankle with the modernist bourgeoisie. It's clearly not very happy under Mr. Erdogan. I mean, where I've kind of had a small amount of dealings with this is having received emails pleading for help from people who want to teach yoga in Turkey. And I suppose an Islamist movement could take a certain reading of yoga and outlaw it or ban it, you know. And so there is probably, coming from that angle, a certain amount of pressure and tension and uncertainty for the Turkish yoga teachers. Something similar happened in Egypt I mean, I'm going back prior to the Arab Spring and so forth. But the Grand Mufti of Egypt outlawed yoga in Egypt on the grounds that it was Hindu. And of course, you know, Hindutva and the Dharmic types, in other words, Indians who use yoga as a kind of a political cudgel, trying to get some leverage or some kudos from the popularity of a type of yoga in the so-called West. You know, and this particular group try and get this kudos by claiming that yoga is the property of India, you know, and it's strictly a matter for Hindus. They might let the rest of us use it, but really it's their Hindu thing. Now, picking up on that, the Grand Mufti of Egypt says that good Muslims can't practice it. And fair enough, you know. The religion, Islam, which will bear no, has no truck with graven images, over and against the religion, which can't get enough graven images, you know, and which the gods have a thousand arms, and which humans and angels and gods copulate all over temples, you know. So you just got like an almost unbridgeable divide there, just on that very on that basis of how far the divinity can and should be represented. So anyway, the Grand Mufti says they're all a load of Hindus, or they're closet Hindus, so ban them. Yeah. I mean, at the time he wasn't in a position to enforce very much. So yoga actually remained pretty popular. Certainly, you know, that kind of, I sometimes call fitness yoga, you know, asana practice. And of course you can do that without uttering the single theological word, you know. So I imagine something similar kicking off in Turkey. And certainly these yoga teachers were a bit worried about regulation. And I mean, what can I do, you know, in Wolverhampton? But what I did do was check out the Turkish constitution. So that was my encounter with it, and I mean I was able to say to him, you know, if you could get a pro bono constitutional lawyer, you might be able to assert your right to freedom of thought, freedom of belief, freedom of practice, freedom to transmit belief and practice, which is instantiated in the Turkish constitution. But of course, those paragraphs in the Turkish constitution mean what Mr. Erdogan wants them to mean, unfortunately. So that was the most I was really able to do there. So there you have it, you know, you have this kind of very fundamental schism that's basically a kind of a class schism. That's playing out, and there's no doubt that Mr. Erdogan has kind of eroded democracy. So, I mean, just the thing of wanting to change the role of the president so that he can continue in power. And obviously he's winning elections by mobilising this Islamic demographic, and some wallahs in the army did the time honoured thing in Turkey of actually attempting to get him out of power with violence, when by capturing key institutions like media and parliament. Apparently they kind of set some bombs off in parliament and shelled it with tanks, you know, it's the parliament building. So interestingly, Erdogan, even though they tried to shut down the internet, he managed to get out through some kind of messenger system, get some kind of widespread video message out saying, well, take to the streets. And of course, a lot of people did. I mean, ironically, in defence of the democracy that he claims elected him. So So everybody's claiming democracy, and I mean, there is that kind of word, democracy, they're becoming again like a kind of political cudgel, you know, as a conceptual lever. And both sides are trying to enlist it because it has this kind of charge of respectability about it. Anyway, that was yesterday. We now have a Prime Minister in the UK. They got that together very quickly, and it's given the Tories an advantage in as much as they now appear to be moving forward. And Theresa May, the new Prime Minister, who's busily channeling Margaret Thatcher, I think, and cashing in on all those resonances. But at the same time, basically, the Tory party is riven, as of course the Labour Party is still faffing around trying to decide where they're going to go, what their leadership's going to be, and all the rest of it. You know, and as I mentioned before, the basic schism there is between the parliamentary Labour Party and the grassroots. And since Ed Miliband, in his wisdom, brought in a cheap, quick affiliate membership for £3, which entitles you to vote for NEC and leaders and stuff, the Labour Party's grassroots absolutely swelled. It's by far the biggest. And people are still joining pretty fast. It's going to be, it's up to around about 500,000 grassroots. And my thought about that is that it is exciting that some kind of a grassroots movement around broad ideas of social justice, around a perception that the world is ruled by the banks and corporations, of which the banking corporations sit on the top. It is ruled by those, by the banks. It is ruled by the media that defend the banks, you know, the billionaires' gutter press. And whose job it is to manipulate the mass. Because at the end of the day, you know, in any situation, ultimately, if only the mass mobilises, it has a massive political power, rather raw power. But there's no army in the world could stop 40 million people on the streets. Push come to shove. I mean, David Hume recognised this, you know, he says the crowd, the herd, the mass has all the political power, if only it would grasp it. And you do realise how much effort is put in to manipulating the great mobile vulgaris, the mob, you might call it. See, mob in that sense isn't a rude word, you know. It's an abbreviation for mobile. The mob is mobile. And has a life of its own, and is incredibly powerful. And of course, what Jeremy Corbyn accidentally happened upon was uttering the right altruism that actually spoke to a large proportion particularly of the younger people in the United Kingdom. You know, they know all this stuff about the banks. They don't read the papers for news. They look on YouTube and Canary and Alternet and God knows what, you know, and they message each other about stuff all the time, you know, and they're a lot more independent of that crude emotional manipulation of some of the less pleasant tendencies of the mass, you know, that you see in the Daily Mail and the News of the World. I mean, the News of the World's gone now, isn't it? Yeah, but the Murdoch press are the worst, you know, and the Murdoch media. And it's just basically trying to get people to behave in ways that don't threaten the 1%, the very rich and powerful. And there's all sorts of ways of doing this. Divide and rule is one of them. well, doing a good job on that. As I the Labour Party is certainly divided, Tory Party is certainly divided, country is certainly divided. And so we've seen this tendency to fragmentation, which is that pressure of division, which is partly all over the world, and it's partly manipulated, but it's partly to do with the realisation that is spreading through the world. The oligarchical control of world, of economies and cultures worldwide, and people and people's lives worldwide, isn't actually really doing the human project that much good, and this realisation is spreading. And I would say that there's a lot of the tension, a lot of the tendency to fragment is coming straight from that, and that in turn is coming straight from the internet, as well as obviously, you know, local factors. You know, there's some very, for instance, in the Turkish case, you notice when I was describing it, they're very specific local factors, local history, you know, all the stuff about Ataturk and wanting to secularise and ensconcing a secular state in his new constitution of the new Turkey. So you get all these particulars in any real situation. And just as a shorthand one says something like, oh well, there's a tendency to fragmentation, I'm not trying to do astrology. I'm actually saying that there are material forces behind that, you know, and one of them, I think, is the new technology and the willingness of the young in developed and developing countries, at least, to take that as their source of information. And hence there is such a battle for the control of the internet. You know, because if you control, there's two things you need to control, really. If you want to rule the world, one is information. You know, that's why billionaires own the media, and the other is money, currency, means of exchange. You know, and if that's controlled, the whole of economic life is controlled, and of course that means all of your consumption and production is controlled by the people who control money. All of what you do about that situation that you find yourself in is controlled by oligarchically owned media. The thing that stands outside that is the free internet at the moment. And of course, a lot of work, a lot of effort, a lot of acts of parliament and so forth, under various excuses such as national security, are being brought in to attempt to control the internet. And I think there's a lot of geeks actually working on making this difficult, you know. I mean, there's obviously the crude stuff of Silk Road and so on. But also you think of efforts like Ethereum and MadeSafe, which in time are going to transform the internet and enable us to have the privacy and the freedom that we want with it. But it'll be a struggle. It will be a struggle. And at the moment, it's down to geeks, really, kind of building stuff, because they want to, because they have a vision. They see that this technology has enormous potential power for liberation and real politics. Even though, of course, it has real potential power for even more mass manipulation and mass surveillance. You know, every tap on the keyboard that you happily put in while you're sending photographs of your dinner to your Facebook friends and all the rest of it, it's recorded, it's kept forever, you know, until there's so much information it can't be. You know, it's kept, then there's this huge pile of data on everybody, you know. And obviously tech companies which may have started out very geekishly, you know, have done what huge corporations do. And I noticed Google sending a CEO or a high official to Bilderberg, you know, which is the kind of think tank of extremely influential people. That more or less tells governments what to do. So, you know, I say Google has this motto, don't do evil, you know, and they started off with geeks in the garage, and that and kind of become culture heroes for that. But now they're at such a size, and they have so much data, and they're trying to put so much of their plant outside the reach of governments that might regulate them. I.e. on, you know, servers and communication stations on balloons or on satellites, you know. Server farms out in international waters at sea, on rafts, powered by wave power and so forth. These are Google ideas, you know. So, in saying the geek shall inherit the earth, I also want to issue a bit of a warning about just how big the tech companies are getting and what they're up to, you know. And of course, Google is dedicated to developing artificial intelligence that can then mine this massive pile of data that it's got. So, there's a lot of power for good or ill in all this stuff. But I say there are a lot of geeks who are aware that they have to put in the technical infrastructure to keep the internet free, you know, and a lot of this work is done open source. It's people sharing ideas from all around the world, but with people who have expertise, you know, and that in itself is a marvellous demonstration of cooperative activity over distance that you can get with the internet. Things like Mozilla Firefox, OpenOffice, Unix, you know, which is at the heart of bloody everything. It's open source. It's done by people sharing ideas because they love to share ideas. You know, they're into the buzz of it. Anyway, may you live in interesting times. I'm getting up towards town now. And I suppose I mentioned shortly before the coup, the attempted coup in Turkey, there was an atrocity in Nice, in the south of France, in which some kind of nutter drove a lorry into a crowd and killed, I don't know, 80 odd people, you know. And he was shot dead by the police there and then. You know, they're trying to say he was some kind of jihadist, and I think one of the groups has claimed that he was one of theirs, but I mean, whether this is true or not, who knows? And the Turkish coup, you'll hear of conspiracy theories and say, well, it's a false flag, so that Erdogan can increase his powers under the excuse of national security, you know, and he can now purge opponents from the army and possibly, you know, from civil service and all the rest of it. So, might be that set up to give him an excuse, you know, but who knows? As I say, yeah, conspiracy theories are a lot of fun. And people do conspire. They certainly do. But there's the forces of history are generally bigger than the best laid schemes, mice and men. And things go off. They're never quite come off. Occasionally they do, of course. You know, but I mean, the fault with most large conspiracy theories is that I imagine that the perfect conspiracy is possible, and that the people conspiring are vastly more intelligent than everybody else, and nobody will spot it. It just don't work like that. But of course, people do. They gather in rooms to try and make stuff happen. And some are more powerful than others, that is certainly true. Anyway, long may the yogis of Turkey prosper. In fact, long may the people of this beautiful earth prosper, this beautiful benighted earth, long may they prosper. for myself, I don't want to say authoritarianism in any sphere of life, you know. There's nothing wrong with natural leadership. But authoritarianism, no. You know, sorry. Anyway, I'm going to finish now.